This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We tape in the offices of Raider, a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work, we understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank, our premier sponsor. They support our community in so many ways, and their dynamic team is committed to serving the banking needs of clients in this region and throughout the southeastern United States. Iberia Bank offers the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit IberiaBank.com for more information. The generosity of Lafayette General Health also makes this podcast possible, and we thank them for being a premier sponsor. As Acadiana's largest nonprofit regional health system, Lafayette General Health is committed to restoring, maintaining, and improving health in the communities it serves. For more information, visit LafayetteGeneral.com. This podcast provides the audio tape of a conference put on by Beacon Community Connections in September 2019. Holly Howitt, director of Beacon, gathered healthcare experts in Lafayette to talk about the current healthcare trends. This was taped prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, but is very relevant information for how healthcare providers may move forward in addressing the best way to treat all of their patients. Joining moderator Sian Robinson of Lafayette General Health is Dr. Gary Wiltz, CEO of TESH Action Clinics, a network of 13 community healthcare centers located in Southwest Louisiana. Gwen Guyot, Vice President of Payer Strategies at LHC. Dr. Kevin Callison, Professor at Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. And Dr. Ziad Ashkar, Louisiana Center for Health Innovation at UL Lafayette. I hope you've all stayed safe. Thank you for listening. This is Jan Swift.
Lafayette General Health System was a partner of Beacon Community Connections even before there was an official Beacon. And Sian Robinson was a chief reason for that. As the Research, Innovation, and Real Estate Investment Executive Director, Sian's job is to find cool, cutting-edge ideas and implement them here. At Lafayette General, Sian has also held the position of Director of Development and Operations and Executive Director of the Foundation. Sian is also an adjunct instructor at the B.I. Moody III College of Business Administration at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And prior to working at Lafayette General, Sian was director of two computer science-based research centers within the University of Louisiana at Lafayette's research department, the Center for Business and Information Technology, and the Center for Visual and Decision Informatics, easy for me to say, and as well as a decades-long entrepreneur in the information technology and management consulting fields. So Sian and I are colleagues in many ways, and I am happy to call him a friend. We make a good pair, as I like to think a little bit of my bleeding heart has rubbed off on him, and I hope some of his business acumen has rubbed off on me. I'm excited about the panel that Sian will moderate. And after telling us a little bit more about what Lafayette General is doing in regards to access driving outcomes. So welcome, Sian.
Thank you. And so let me move into this to this panel, and what we're really looking at are healthcare trends and patterns, including disruptions. So before I get started, I'd like each of and every one of the panel members to take a couple minutes to introduce themselves, what they do for their organizations, and maybe a little bit of insight into the panel. So ladies first, Gwen, if you could go, please.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Guyot. I currently serve as Vice President of Payer Strategies for LHC Group here in town. I'm actually a native Louisianian and have spent most of my professional career in healthcare from a finance angle. And so I cut my teeth in emergency medicine and then spent some time in the public policy world working for a local lobbying group. And what that allowed me to do is to apply those finance principles to our policy arena. arena and really figure out what works, what's going to be a tangible option, how do we navigate some of those things that we all have to navigate to be successful in our ventures. Now I'm with LHC. We're a large home health and hospice provider that originated in Opelousas. We're currently in 35 states. We have the ability to serve over 60% of the U.S. Population over age 65, which is a really, really great statistic, and I think we should all be proud that it's here in our hometown. And in the role I play, I work with our traditional payers, like Blue Cross Blue Shield, to secure our revenue for the company so that when our nurses are in the home caring for the patients, we can pay for them. So happy to be here today.
Thank you, Gwen. Dr. Wilkes?
Maybe I can take this off of here.
There you go. My name is Gary Wiltz. I'm the CEO of Tesh Action Clinics, which is a network of community health centers in southwest Louisiana, covering about seven parishes. I'm a native New Orleanian, had the distinction of being born at what we used to refer to as Big Charity Hospital, and had the good fortune of training there. We were just discussing before the panel began the Tulane connection that we all have here. So I did my undergrad at Tulane, medical school at Tulane, and residency at Tulane. And in that role, I had exposure to a population of patients that I think in this society, in this world, were considered the underserved. So I'm an internist. While in medical school, I received a scholarship with the National Health Service Corps that assigned me to Franklin, Louisiana, which is down the road from here. That was 37 years ago. I had a three-year commitment, but you'll find that one of the best recruiting tools you can have is to get people to drink the Bayou Tesh water or to marry a young lady from the community, which is what I did. So that was the recruitment and retention tool, and I'm delighted to be here. I also had the honor of being the president of the National Association of Community Health Centers, which serves 30 million people in the United States. It's the largest primary care network in the nation, bigger than Kaiser, bigger than the VA system. We have been in existence as a movement for over 50 years. Tesh Action Clinic is the oldest and the first community health center in the state of Louisiana. We'll be celebrating 45 years in November. And the population that was described in the previous session that Camden mentioned was something that I was particularly interested in, and I think we can bring that perspective as to the challenges that are associated with that population. So I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Dr. Wilkes. Dr. Callison.
Hi, my name is Kevin Callison. I am a health policy and economics professor at Tulane University, so again, the Tulane connection. Most of my work now that is not teaching involves Medicaid research, so we are doing a kind of a large-scale evaluation of Medicaid expansion in Louisiana. We've done some work around access and health outcomes, and we're continuing that work. We're also now, a lot of my time is being taken up by evaluating the Section 1115 demonstration waiver around SUD, OUD use in Louisiana. So since the approval of that waiver, there's a kind of a five-year evaluation process there that we're heading up. So a lot of work around health policy that involves the Medicaid population.
Dr. Ashkar.
Hello, my name is Ziad Ashkar. I've been practicing in Acadia now since 1995. During that time, also, I had different leadership roles. Most recently, I was the chief medical officer of Lafayette General Health. For the past 4 months or so, I had the honor of joining UL. I'm in the Faculty of Nursing, and in addition, I'm the director of Louisiana Center for Health Innovation. We're trying to bridge data science with health outcome research, working towards improving healthcare outcomes for the population. Thank you.
So thank you, Dr. Ashkar. So Gwen, we'll have you kick it off. So what do you think is the single greatest disruptor in healthcare today?
So I gave it a bit of thought, and I was trying to come up with something that wouldn't be duplicative across the board. But I do have to say that healthcare is late to the game on the consumerism movement, right? So we've seen in every other industry the voices of the ultimate customer shining through, and we're starting to see that here with the access available through mobile programs, with the influence that people have through media. It's finally the voice of the patient is starting to shine through. I think that that's a welcome event. I think that that's going to hopefully bring a lot of things to the table that can sometimes be forgotten. And so I'm really eager to see how that continues to develop for all of us.
So why don't we just sort of go down the line?
Okay. I pulled an article, I think, that set the table for me for the discussion. It was entitled Disrupted or Disruptor. Which one will you be? And in that article, it references some studies that were done. But in particular, it says that companies that wait until the market demands a reaction that are at the greatest risk of being replaced with younger, more agile organizations that are already utilizing new technologies. And so technology, and I've learned some new vernacular when I was doing the research on what they were describing. They were saying that the United States economy as a whole is only realizing 18% of its digital potential. So I think the challenge we have today in a digital world is to follow up on what you said, is how do we marry high tech with high touch? Because as much as we can develop data and artificial intelligence, the human factor and the human element is still, to me, the X factor that has to still be a part of the equation.
And I think, Dr. Wilkes, what we saw with Beacon was the last mile problem, right? Which is we can put technology in place and risk score people. We can sit there and we can try to identify them and put their record in the EHR. But at the end of the day, what it was our killer app was a phone and a person that would making that phone call to make sure that these non-clinical care coordinators and navigators were making sure these people were getting the services that they absolutely needed.
Absolutely.
Dr. Callison.
So I kind of have two answers to this question. One is the short-term answer, and one is kind of the longer-term answer. And I think I used to teach in a business school, and there was a lot of talk about disruption. And you know, you've heard this for years, I'm sure, in healthcare. And I think in the short term, the answer is probably the biggest disruptor is the electorate and the elected representatives, right, that change policy. So if you think about the biggest disruptions that have happened in healthcare in the last 60 years or so, it's what? Creation of Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, expansion of Medicaid coverage, so movement to pay for performance. I think these are the kind of disruptors we're seeing in the near term, as opposed to something like, you know, Amazon coming in and changing the way that everybody experiences healthcare. But I do think to reiterate what's been said before, I think in the long term, this consumerism is really the answer for disruption. You know, it's the customer experience in healthcare is not always great, and in fact is often not great. And in terms of technology adoption, healthcare has been very slow to the game. I don't know how many of you are faxing your information to industries outside of healthcare, but healthcare has been a late adopter in this, and a lot of that is because there's not a lot of competition driving these sorts of adoptions of these technologies. So, you know, I'll save this for a question I think is going to be asked later, but I think this competition and driving change in healthcare based on the consumer experience is something that in the long term may be the biggest disrupting force.
Yeah, this is great discussion. So, the most important thing, I mean, think about it this way. I mean, I put it in perspective. I mean, I think the major driver is the cost, right? I mean, almost 20% of our GDP is spent on healthcare. So all these disruptions are in a way to try to bring down the cost. Now, we tried something in the 80s, 90s. Remember what was it? It was the HMO movement. And one of the drivers for failures for those were what? I mean, we did not have good internet then. We merely had Windows 95. So the computer technology is advancing. The memory is terabytes and zettabytes of data is advancing. So you have machine learning, you have deep learning, you have artificial intelligence. So all of these, finally, hey, the data's there. I mean, it's always been there, but now we can capture digital, video, audio, imaging, information. So now we're trying to understand with advanced in computer technologies how we can interpret and use the data. So this is how you can do analytics, and this is what we're trying to do, for example, for risk certification when you talk of population health, the healthy ones, how we can prevent them from getting sick, and even those, how you can stratify where they live, what kind of conditions we need to make sure that they don't develop any diseases, etc.
It's the proactive versus reactive, and healthcare has been reactive the entire time. Dr. Will.
Yeah, let me just go back to the future, okay? When I was a young medical student many, many years ago, I guess 40 years plus, there was a lecture by a futurist, Dr. Hyman, ironically the same name as the center. It was at Touro in New Orleans, and he predicted in 50 years Americans would be receiving their health care at a department store. And I can tell, if I ask for a show of hands in the audience, he predicted it was going to be at Sears, because if you remember back then, Sears was where America what?
That's right.
Shopped.
That's right.
And yesterday's news, if you saw it, when Walmart opened in Dallas, Georgia, you're talking about cost. They're predicting they can lower the cost by 40% of the model that they're, and their model is the similar one that we use in FQHCs, right, where they have on site primary care, behavioral health, dental, lab, and imaging. So when you talk about disruptors and access to care, that is a major factor that's going to be out there that we're going to have to compete with.
So can you continue on that fashion? We are at Lafayette General, right, and now with Ochsner, are combating those non-traditional entrants into our space. I mean, you know, we've already said Amazon with Dr. Atul Gawande leading the efforts there. CVS bought Aetna. You know, Walmart or Walgreens are going to acquire Humana. You've got these non-traditional, you know, boxes essentially entering the space, and they're saying we're going to take over chronic care and chronic conditions to be the providers. What does that do for you all and in your models when you're sitting here?
I mean, I can take that. But remember, when you talk artificial intelligence, it's all about targeting.
You're not talking about me.
It's all about targeting, right? So these companies were so good in targeting consumers, right? I mean, you go on Amazon, they know what book you like to read, and they target you. And healthcare is waking up to it, and you know what? They're going into the spectrum of healthcare, so we're targeting patients who are the consumers. So this is why these companies are leveraging, and to buffer the cost, you need to do mergers and acquisitions for vertical integration, to negotiate with pharmacies, to lower the drug costs, because they're up to 17% of healthcare costs.
Right. But the great equalizers are these things.
Yes.
You know, because smartphones, Fitbits, all the things, the consumerism that you mentioned, you know, and as I still see patients, and I'm going to refer back to what you said earlier about the social determinants.
Yes, sir.
I mean, yesterday I was trying to convince a young woman to get a mammogram. And she's saying, you know, I got my electric bill cut off. I had my lights cut off. So the last thing on her mind was, I'm not going to get a mammogram. I need to go back and try to get my electricity turned back on. But these smartphones and the Fitbit and the consumerism and the empowerism that it gives them, as well as providers. You know, in some of the articles I was reading, when you think about the capability of what we have, right now on smartphones you can run EKGs. So if I can do an EKG as an internist, and I have you put your fingers on it and run an EKG, I don't need what? An EKG technician or the machine. If I can adapt a respiratory device to measure respiratory, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And do ultrasounds off of this, it's that automation. And I know you said politics earlier. When I listened to Andrew Yang, and he talked about the displacement of 4 million jobs because of automation, that is something I think that's going to really have to be addressed as we displace people.
And so, Gwen, continuing on this, I mean, the home ecosystem that's going to be set up soon, in my mind, eventually you're going to be, LHC Group's going to be the one really doing the taking care of the people, because you're able to set this ecosystem of devices up that Dr. Wiltz just discussed. And so I get down to the question of policy and payer at that point in time. The tech technology is exceeding. Now, how do we get that to the table?
Agreed. And it was interesting because as you were saying, well, what does that mean for you? I thought, great things for me, right? I think, but remember this. So the technology and the access and all of those things, the next generation doesn't value convenience the way we've valued convenience because they've always had it. And so what they're going to place value on is we're going to have to be prepared for that. And I would say that the price of doing business is to use our data, to use our processes, and to be efficient. When you can retain that clinical excellence and that human touch at the end of that spectrum, that's when you've really done it. And that's when you've served your patient population. That's what I think the goal needs to be.
Well, I think you have to pick the population that you're serving. I had queued up on my phone. I was going to play the Queen song for the millennials theme. I want it all, right. And I want it now. You know, and that's why urgent care. That's why I think, you know, they want it. And they, when you do the marketing, there are 10,000 people a day in the country turning 65 and older. So home health and the services outside the office are critical. But for millennials, they don't want a primary care provider. They want to go urgent care, they want a convenience. And so we're going to have to position ourselves to meet the demands of what is changing. And those that don't interface and don't do predictive or follow where it's already too late for some people if they're not engaged on that level.
Dr. Callison.
I mean, I think these are, this goes back to the consumerism idea. This is a great point. For so long, healthcare has not been very consumer friendly in the sense that, you know, if I need to go to the doctor, my doctor's office is open 8 to 5. Well, I work 8 to 5, you know? So it's these kind of things that I think we most of us are accustomed to. We know that dealing with healthcare, interacting with the healthcare industry is going to be kind of a pain. It's going to take time. There are going to be frustrations. But, a new generation coming up who doesn't have those experiences may have different expectations, and if those expectations drive where money is going and drive behavior, then I do think that it has the potential to change things. The question will be, though, is are there going to be alternatives that allow for people with a different demand than older generations to really leverage those alternative options and to push healthcare in a different direction?
So, Dr. Callison, I'm a Yankee. Okay, so I'm going to use don't hold that against me, y'all. I'm going to use a Yankee phrase. You always skate to where the puck's going to be, not to where the puck was, right? So where should we be skating to? What's the trend that you see we should be skating to?
Well, again, that's I think in the short term, it's really tough to project something like this because we don't, you know, policies change and those policy changes come with different regulations, and it's really tough to navigate these things when you're dealing with a heavily regulated industry like healthcare. But in terms of thinking into the future, I do think that there's going to be a point where we have to see whether healthcare as an industry decides to continue along in the same kind of path that it's been going, or whether it adopts, embraces some of these consumer, the things that are more friendly to consumers. And I don't know that the industry will do it on its own. I think it's going to take some sort of outside motivation, whether that's regulatory or whether it's competition from somebody like Amazon or somebody coming in, and that may drive those changes. So yeah, I think healthcare traditionally has been kind of skate to where the puck was and not where it's going.
Gwen?
I think it's always tough, especially when you're straddling these two environments. We've been a reactionary industry, and you have to be, right? You go towards the high-risk patients, and you try to resolve for that. What I'd love to see us do is skate towards the health and maintain that health. And so if there is any way to balance the two and identify how do you address high-risk and how do you get that better, but all the while, how do you prevent the high-risk from happening in the first place? What do you do with your children? What do you do with your young adults? We've got the ability to foresee things before they happen, so now we got to harness that and actually prevent the high risk from taking place.
Yeah. Let me interject a little Southern religious philosophy to this Yankee here. Blessed are the flexible, for they shall not be bent out of shape. And if you're not agile, you're not dynamic, and you're not able to adapt, then you will be extinct. And just a great example, Renee Stansberry with Tobacco Free Living, and we've been working on passing ordinances and getting folks in all the different parishes. We're in St. Mary and Terrebonne of banning tobacco and smoke-free facilities. And then what pops up, this vaping crisis, that she's actually way ahead of the curve. So I asked, and it has to be a multi-pronged approach. So primary prevention is critical. So policies and things that we're doing in the school systems to with the DARE programs and things that are preventing kids from doing substance use, doing that, that's critical. But then when you have these crises, you have to be, we're going to have to pass some policies that are going to ban these products. You know, smoking kills, regular tobacco smoking kills, but not instantly like vaping does. So, I mean, so now you have to be adjustable, and in the current legislative session, now laws are being drafted right now to do that, but we have to do educate. There are some parents that are, in their mind, they thought vaping was safe. You know, so now, but so you never know what's coming around the corner. I had the good fortune of co-chairing Governor Edwards' healthcare transition team. I can tell you by Medicaid, making Medicaid expansion and bringing states that didn't have it, we made a tremendous impact on those 450,000 people that are now on Medicaid. If the election brings a different change in administration and that gets disbanded, or if the ACA gets overturned, you're going to have just total disruption in the whole healthcare delivery system.
Z, what do you think?
Where are we heading?
I'm sorry, Dr. Ashkar.
It's okay.
Excuse me.
It's good. I mean, we've been friends for a long time. So where are we heading is an interesting question. If I'm a futurist, I think the future is precision medicine, which is, you know, with advancing so much in genomics and DNA analysis, and if combined that with big data, we're able to target specific disease entities, and we're able to focus. I mean, oncology has been pioneered with specific genomic targeted therapies, but it's going to flow across all disease spectrum. And it's not only be to treat disease, it's going to be to risk stratify, to prevent disease. So I think the genomic data is going to be our future, and I will not be surprised in 5 to 10 years that precision medicine is going to be taking lead.
Thank you. So I'm going to sort of switch gears a little bit. I have the pleasure of running a couple of some innovation funds for Lafayette General, so we can come in and work with these companies that are startups and get them some seed funding and then use our sandbox as, you know, and respectfully, you know, LHC Group is part of our second fund, and, you know, and use our horsepower of the ecosystem to bring these companies to market. And so, Gwen, I'm going to ask you, if you stepped out of your role at LHC Group and you were coming to seek funding from the Innovation Fund, what company would you be bringing to the table?
Thank you for putting me on the spot with that question. Because Sian mentioned that he would be asking something along the lines of, if you were bringing something new to the industry, what would that be? And I struggle quite a bit with that, and I'm afraid I might disappoint the audience, because I don't, my role is not to be bringing anything new. I'm not a futurist, I'm not a visionary. What I do best is I make things better, or I create a process around something that's tangible. And so what I would actually like you to do, Sian, is ask me to sit behind the table and evaluate those programs, because I think what I can do well is legitimize business concerns, thinking about the economics and thinking about the policy, and also thinking about the application to make sure that what we are focusing our energy and our investments on is something that's going to stick.
So since they're recording this, I'm going to play that back, and when we have a company that's coming through the vetting process, you will be at the table, okay? Dr. Ashkar, what do you think? What would you do?
I conduct a symphony orchestra. No, that's my other thing I like to do. Anyway.
So what you don't know is he's a fabulous musician, and he plays in the on-call band, right?
Yeah,
so I think if you could pay him what he gets paid now to play the keyboard and conduct, he'd be done.
So
respectfully, UL people.
So that's very interesting, because I have to put my thinking frame as a physician and everything else, but if I like to do things, I like to focus more on prevention, because unfortunately, most of the cost goes into the terminal diseases, terminal stages, terminal illnesses. If we can have some alignment between strong research, data science, informatics, genetics, genomics, and align all the payers and the providers and the patients and everyone towards prevention. For example, when you look at Louisiana, we're ranked number 50 in many healthcare outcomes, hypertension, diabetes, kidney disease, mortality. There is a common denominator, for example, it's obesity. So if we can find some more specific information, is it only diet or exercise, or there are some genetic determinants? Is there some geographic determinants? Is there some other issues? So these things I would be interested to do more, and I hope we can find some solutions.
Dr. Callison.
I mean, I think if I had a good answer to this question, I'd probably be doing it and not doing what I'm doing now. But I think kind of the boring answer would be that I think I understand payment systems and changes around payment policy pretty well. So, you know, consulting in an area like that. I think the more interesting answer is the point about prevention. And you know, you mentioned obesity, and I think that's important. I also think, personally, education. If you look at correlates between, you know, the longevity and good health, education is probably the strongest predictor of that. So, you know, my passion would be that we promote education as a way to improve health outcomes.
So, Dr. Wiltz.
I'm going to go back to what I said in the beginning. If you could figure out a way to marry high touch with high tech, you know, the human element absolutely has to be a component of it. But how to get the patients empowered to use the data, collect the data, and make informed decisions, and make the lifestyle changes that they need to make. Half of what we treat is preventable disease, you know, and changing the culture. And I think what's being held today with this summit is a key to it, because the answer that we need in the country is not going to be crafted out of Washington, D.C. or state capitals. It has to begin from local communities like you're doing here. No one can help save us from us but us. But if you put in a room a strategy where everyone, and I like to break it down to what I call metrics that matter. Going back to what was just said, you know, you're talking about obesity, smoking. When you teach medical students, you can teach them all the pharmacology, all the things that we teach them. But if you can get someone to have a healthy pregnancy with a healthy child with normal birth weight, and that child never begins smoking, doesn't become overweight, exercises, eat right, and does all the things that they need to do, and has all the preventive things, then you can have a healthier population. Then you mix in the social determinants component, and then you can make a difference. But until that time, you have to have a multifaceted approach.
So I kind of do have an idea. It would be to use the analytics and the social media much the way that Amazon knows that I want to order some new Bare Minerals makeup before I even logged on, to figure out what makes a person tick, and then get in the way of that, you know, or get in front of that conscious decision to make a bad decision, right? So on Monday morning, I flew out and my watch reminded me that I normally do a lot better by this time. But it's those things. What kind of app or what kind of device can we create that harnesses the things, the determinants, or the genetic conditions that are putting us down the wrong path, and then gets in front of it to help us navigate into a better one?
So I'm going to open this up to the entire panel, and we have a room full of healthcare professionals, not just clinicians, but administrators and all kinds of folks here. If you had one piece of advice to offer them, what would it be?
Obviously, listen to the people that you're trying to serve and get feedback from the people that, you know, people, one of the first rules of medicine, of course, is first do no harm. But as my old medicine professor used to tell me, people will tell you what's wrong. You just have to listen. So I think if you do the right, someone mentioned earlier about the community, it needs an assessment. You can figure out what the community is desiring and try to meet that need. We call it being community responsive. So that would be the advice, you know, try to tailor make it to what you begin with the end in mind of what people recognize as the problem.
Anyone?
I would say always ask why, innovate, and stay up to date. Speaking of that, did anyone watch YouTube, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of UK, talking about AI? It's very interesting. I urge you just to go on it and see. It's predicting like we're going to have Terminator with red eyes invading the Earth, and we're going to have legless. I mean, it's very interesting to see how some people perceive AI is going to happen in the future.
Well, it's sort of when Skynet becomes self-aware, right, is what we're waiting for. Right? For those of you who are old enough to understand that reference.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have any real good piece of advice other than the fact that I think the discussion we've had around health behaviors and things that influence our health outside of medicine are critically important. I think if you look at the gains we've made in longevity and improvements in health over the last, you know, half century or so, most of it's been behavioral. It's been the reduction in smoking rates. It's been the other improvements that we've made outside of direct healthcare. And so, you know, the one thing that really interests me, we've talked about vaping and we've talked about some of these behavioral things. That's kind of what I'm interested in and keeping an eye on. So policies that can improve health. One of the areas that I'm doing some research in now is paid sick leave and some of these things that aren't directly related to medical care, but we know are correlated with improvements in health later on. So I'd like people to pay more attention to those sorts of things.
My advice would be that there is always one true north, and it is that there's an interaction between a clinician and a patient, and that is the most important part. Whether it's a doctor or a nurse or a social worker or even just somebody providing access to care, that is the moment that we're about, and we need to be standing in support of that.
So I think we have a few minutes to allow for some Q&A. So if there are some folks in the audience that would like to ask our panelists. Yes, ma'am. Dr. Oberleitner. I'm sorry. I've got like a spotlight right in my face.
Thank you. Great thought-provoking questions and answers. What can we learn from other countries? I think we can learn a lot from other countries on things that we can do better. We have young people who have all of the opportunities in the world who are in our top educational institutions. They're stressed. They're anxious. They don't know their way forward. What can we do better and take lessons from other countries?
Well, I think the proof is in the data that we don't enjoy the life expectancy of some of the other countries. I kind of like the French, you know, drink wine and relax and have 30-hour work weeks and do other things. The Mediterranean diet has been proven to be one of the most effective diets. I like the World Health Organization definition of health, you know, and I have the good fortune of being on the board of trustees of Osteopathic Medical School, and their tenet is, it's medical, spiritual, and mental. They deal with all the elements that you mentioned, and there is a spiritual component that I don't think we recognize. I don't want to sound like Ms. Williamson on the candidate's reel, but I do think that's a component, and there are lessons learned that we can learn from the lifestyle, I think is what you're referring to, and the American lifestyle, the rat race, just that component, that crucible, you add that on top of all the things that we do to ourselves, and it just sets us up for failure. So I think we have to address that.
So if we spend a lot more money on healthcare than other countries do. We spend almost 20% of our GDP. The average developed country spends about half that on healthcare, and our outcomes, at least if you measure in terms of longevity, mortality rates, they don't look as good as other countries. So how much of that is attributable to medical care, and how much of that is attributable to lifestyle? I think those are questions that we don't quite know the answer to, but it's pretty clear that we're spending a lot more and not getting as much as some other countries, and I think the answer to that question is why that's the case is really important, and I'd like to keep digging to understand that, but I don't think we have a great answer for that question yet.
Yeah, I would also, I echo that. I actually was in France this summer, and I watched a home health nurse come in and perform a service on my mother-in-law, actually. And the total cost for her visit was €4. It was harder to make change than it was for us to pay her. And so I don't know the answer. I don't know how you get there. But I really would like to find out. And I'll certainly go back to France for longer if anybody wants to make that happen.
I'll need the delegation.
And I think, oh, you have another question?
Hi, great conversation. Thank you. I'm Bradley Cruz, co-chair for Healthy Acadiana. When you were discussing consumerism, some of the words that jumped out from you was combatant, competition, pain, frustration. So are your organizations truly going to embrace that consumerism as we move across? And then as the topic is trends, do you see that trend ever moving into early childhood centers and or schools so that we can get them that access to earlier?
So Bradley, I'm actually going to try to help with that one instead of just moderate. So one of the platforms that we, absolutely consumerism and consumerization of healthcare is immensely important to Lafayette General and whatever sort of version we are in the next few years, okay? Right? And first and foremost, let's talk about schools. That's why we did the school-based telehealth program. You know, St. Martin Parish fully covered. We have money to roll out from the USDA grants we received for Vermilion, Acadia Parish, SLCC, LSUE. We believe to meet people where they are, and I think that that's something we've gotten away from, right? That we've created an app that right now you all can go, and I think Blue Cross and Blue Shield has the same back-end provider that we have, that you can go and do a telehealth visit right now in this room and visit with one of our physicians, right? So we understand that, but we're not yet really, really good at it, right? And so you know who's kicking our behinds? It's the CVSs of the world that have what Dr. Ashkar was talking about, the predictive analytics of our buying pattern. They know what we're buying, and they know how to treat you. And so we have to move down that spectrum. I spent a lot of my time in management consulting and IT before I got here, and I did a lot of work within finance. I can tell you back in the 90s, we were figuring out how you all were banking, and then we were telling you how you should bank, right? We told you what the delivery network should be, and so we were able to score you and say, this person's really Mac and online banking, and push you in that direction. We're going to be doing that at Lafayette General, you know, using the deep data that we have to be able to do that type of predictive analytic that says, hey, we think this person's going to need X, and then reach out to them through these various different narrow networks or risk-based contracts or wherever we get into to be able to provide X. So yeah, we are moving in that direction, Bradley, absolutely.
Yeah, let me just follow up on that. As you know, there's a tool called the ACE predictor, the adverse childhood events that can predict that. So that incorporates a lot of what you were talking about. So knowing those things and trying to intervene, that's what I'm saying. If you do the analytics and you do the interventions that can, you know that if they follow this pattern, that's going to lead to that outcome, and do the intervention at the appropriate time, you can.
I was just having a conversation about that, ACEs, so Adverse Childhood Experience. It's a score, and really what it does is, I'm going to say to you this, trauma is the gateway drug. Right, trauma causes a lot of the problems that we see in youth and adults. And if you're able to understand that, and so I sit on the boards of CASA, Court Appointed Special Advocates for South Louisiana, and the Boys and Girls Clubs of Acadiana, and we're beginning to, as our club kids come in, or these kids we're taking care of through CASA, they're getting ACE scores. And that helps us better treat them in the environment that they're in either the club or with one of our advocates. It's absolutely essential. Other questions?
Over here.
Hi, Keisha Arangeletti with 232 Help. I just had a quick question. I know we mentioned all the different things as far as Louisiana being last, and we talked about, you know, what are other countries doing, but I'm interested in knowing, because some of the things mentioned that I've heard, you know, we should have this or we should have that, we kind of already do, but it's isolated. So what do we have in other areas of the state, or what do we have in other areas of this country that South Louisiana needs to be implementing, whether it's the app that you discuss, or, you know, just anything that you all have seen somewhere else that is tangible that we can implement here in South Louisiana where we can be on a level playing field? Thank you.
I think I may be the oldest one on the panel, so I can. The most frustrating thing I've had my whole life experience is I've been on every healthcare reform panel since Edwin Edwards. And for the last 25 years, the United Healthcare Foundation has ranked Louisiana 48th, 49th, and 50th. And they don't just rank you, they tell you the metrics that use that are involved in ranking you. That's followed by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that does the county health rankings that ranks every county in the United States. And I think that is the roadmap that we should be looking at. As I said earlier, you can't craft it out of D.C. or Baton Rouge. You have to break it into units that you can, like, to eat an elephant one bite at a time. So what you have gathered here today and what you're building upon and the work that Holly and her group are doing, that's what you have to look at, the metrics that matter, because I can tell you St. Landry Parish is different than Franklin Parish. You have to look at the people in those communities that are going to make it sustainable. That's what happens. Every new administration that comes in has a thought process. You know, I remember when Fred Cerise was head of DHH and we were going to move the rankings from 48 to 39th. We put the plan together, Governor Blanco. We went all around the whole region. We were doing these things, and then the administration changes, and you have a whole set of different folks. It's the people in the community that have to take ownership and sustain it. It's the people that are born, live, work, educate, eventually pass away in those communities are going to make the difference.
Dr. Ashkar.
I think it takes a partnership. I think, yes, patients, individuals, physicians, state policy levels. I mean, there are many advances going on in the state of Louisiana, for example, that the project to cure hepatitis C is a major ordeal that's going to happen, and there is a plan to hopefully cure the disease within 5 years, and it takes partnerships to do that. So, for example, at UL, we're trying to work with the state how we can leverage that. In addition, the payers are really taking a very progressive move. I mean, I was at HIMSS, Louisiana, yesterday, and Blue Cross has significant cool technologies to try to work on population health towards prevention, sometimes having some no copay for some kind of groups or sending nurses at home to prevent diseases and illnesses. I think it's taking a teamwork, leveraging all the intellectual capacities we have among all the subgroups, and we're going to get there, and I think we are going to improve.
And I think that, especially for this group, one of the things, like if you mentioned the payers, we're going beyond the medical intervention and looking at social determinants, right? Food and those types of things. And so, honestly, when we get to the communities, they're going to say, where you been? We've been working on this for quite some time. But I think we're kind of witnessing the convergence of that, where there's starting to be more interest and more money behind it and more recognition that, you know, building those supports, whether it's Boys and Girls Club or the food farm, like the food distribution channels, all of those things contribute toward the overall health of that patient population.
I thought I saw a question somewhere here in the middle. Okay, we got one, and then I think two, and then we're going to be done.
Okay, hi. I'm Sagan. I'm a behavioral health utilization at Aetna. I'm actually more interested in the millennial statement you all mentioned before. It was a joke one of the doctors mentioned. I want it all. And speaking from a millennial perspective, maybe I'm an anomaly, but I prefer a PCP that I have a relationship with. And I'm just curious to know, what are your ideas or perspectives on the advantages of IT and technology as it relates to your practices? Because I did hear something about consumerism and furthering that rivet, but what helps kind of build that bridge?
So when Dr. Oberleitner asked what other countries do differently, you know, care is very personal, right? I think we've technologized healthcare a little bit, and we've gotten away from one person taking care of another, right? Now, can we do all that we're talking about with deep data, big data? Absolutely. Can you have a relationship with a PCP through a telemedicine visit? Maybe. But at the end of the day, it really is. I mean, you know, I started off our magic app at Beacon. When we started it, it was the telephone and a wonderful voice on the other end of the phone making sure that that person knew that they were cared for, loved, and were being provided services.
I'm going to go back to what I started off with, high tech marrying high touch. People want to be, we have to teach medical students how to go and interact with people. You know, we have how to put your hand on someone to comfort them. That is just insane that we have to teach caregivers or healers how to do that. But that relationship that you describe is the ideal in my mind. you know, and but the marketing keeps telling us that millennials, for the most part, and you are probably outside that box, but people still, at the end of the day, want a human touch, a voice, and to interpret. You can go to WebMD all you want, but I can tell you patients that when they get a patient portal and they get one value that is not pathologic, but they freak out because they don't know how to interpret it. So we'll always be in need, I think, because they won't not interpret the data. So, but that you can't substitute to me that relationship.
Thank you. I'm just going to sort of restate what y'all are saying, because I do think this issue, the description of the authentic healing relationship, I think is just so important. I would guess that every one of us in here has decided not to take the medicine that's been prescribed, or not to follow through with it, or not to do what the doctor's telling us to, or not even quit smoking, because it's not always just education and knowledge. There's something else about whether we believe the person who's giving us the advice, whether we trust them, whether they believe that they're going to really, they really are in our world. And so I agree with you, this idea of marrying technology. We have to do things differently, but we also cannot lose that sense that we are being cared for. And I love the quotes that we heard earlier today about the people who are experiencing the complex patients, but what's most important to them, you know, it's are they being cared for? We've seen that, and I will just add one more little thing. Here in this area, I'm sure most of y'all know, many of y'all probably know, about the maternal and infant early childhood home visiting programs that are in right here in this community. And it's home visiting by nurses starting during pregnancy in the first 2 or 3 years of life. Those programs have huge data behind them in terms of prevention. And they do many of the same things that we're talking about. Very much relationship-focused, strengths-based, reaching people where they are. And these mothers and these babies are making tremendous changes. So anyway, that is here in this community. So I just think relationship always.
Thank you, Dr. Zena. So I see behind me Holly's about to give us the hook. Gwen, Dr. Ashkar, Dr. Callison, Dr. Wills, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedules to come talk to us today and serve on this panel.
Thank you.